As Canada catches a cold, we're fast out of time, Hannah.
I
But
just want to say one word that really the Canadian government is really strategically hurting the Canadian people's strategic interest by all this support for U.S. imperialism and Israeli settler colonialism.
well, I never mind the moral damage to us all. I mean, on another level altogether. Palestinian Prisoners Day, April 17th. That's Friday at Creekside Park in Vancouver, 1455 Quebec Street. It's listed here in your poster at cpavancouver.org as a 6:30 p.m. Gathering, I suppose. What can people expect, Hanna, when they go there?
Well, basically, we're gonna, ask for the release of all these Palestinian prisoners and support them in this crucial stage, and to remember them as heroes of the Palestinian people's struggle, and to denounce all those, including the Canadian government, who are supporting this brutality in Palestine and this genocide taking place in genocide. And we're going to be loud. And, if people say why we are disrupting the traffic or whatever it is in the city, they should realize that Canada, from its inception, participated in the dispossession and supported the genocide of the Palestinian people even before 48, since the 20s. For people who want more information, there is an article I wrote. It's called We Remember Canada. On Remembrance Day, I wrote an article how we remember Canada and its complicity in Palestinian genocide. Actually, you could search our website on Canadian complicity. You'll find many, many resources there, and it shows you the deep complicity of Canadian government, successive Canadian government since the 20s in supporting the settler colonialist project in Palestine. So if people want more information, our website is full of this information.
Well, and the poster too has the famous shackled hands of Marwan Barghouti flashing a peace sign as he was arrested. Barghouti's been in prison longer than most of our listeners have been alive. And there was disturbing news just today, even of he being, and he's not a young man, and he being brutally assaulted even yet in prison.
He facing terrible situation, really. They aiming to murder him, basically. That's their objective, and they to a certain degree they are succeeding in murdering him. I won't be surprised waking up tomorrow and announcing that he succumbed to his injuries from the torture.
The Guardian has a piece out just today. Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti at risk in Israeli jails as he faces escalating abuse. For people who aren't aware of who he is and why Israel is so worried about him and treating him so bad, imagine Nelson Mandela after 25 years in prison being tortured systematically at an advanced age, and you'll sort of get an idea. Barghouti was seen as the a political answer, perhaps, to cohabitation in Palestine.
And he's often called the Mandela of Palestine.
These are dark days indeed, and I see that you're posting on your Twitter site too about what's going on in Lebanon, and we're seeing a reenactment or an expansion of what we've seen in Gaza these last terrible 2.5 years in the southern part of Lebanon.
Over a million people already being evacuated from the south of
And
Lebanon.
Canada, and what's Canada's position again? The government of Canada on what's going on in Lebanon?
It's a joke, basically. We denounce, but we send military equipment so they'll finish the job. I mean, what kind of position is that? Actually, this position is not unique just to Canada. It's to most Western country. They denounce and then they send arms to Israel to continue the massacre and the genocide and their mission in their dream of expanding Israel to the greater Israel. So, I mean, it's been amongst supporters and amongst the Palestinians and the Arabs and the Muslims all over the world. They show the hypocrisy and the thing. You know, just one example here. For example, when we asked David Abbey to take off the wines off the shelves, that was in 2008, I believe. He used to be the Attorney General then. He told us, you know, we can't do that because it's a consumer choice, you know, and it's regulated by the Canadian government. And then when the Russian invaded Ukraine, he took the vodka in 2 days. We've been struggling for almost 18 years to take the illegal, and they consider it illegal, not just in Canada, but even the even NDP resolution talked about products from the occupied territory is illegal and should be opposed, you know. And, you know, again, he did it with the wines from California. So it shows you how hypocritic this stupid, excuse my language, sitting in Victoria, you know, David Abbey, who really big hypocrite, and he is big supporter of Israeli genocide.
Yes, and he and his friend Selena Robinson, who has gained infamy by her own right.
She's another story, really. She called it, piece of land, you know?
Just a shitty piece of land or something, if I remember correctly. Yeah. It's Palestinian Prisoners Day, April 17th, Friday coming, 2026, 6:30, Creekside Park. That's 1455 Quebec Street in Vancouver. You can see more of the CPA's work at cpavancouver.org. Thanks a lot, Hannah, for coming on and speaking with us again today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, and keep up the good work, Chris.
Well, my great pleasure. I want everyone to stick around after the break. I'll be back with the last half, or last quarter, really, of my discussion with John Helmer from last week, where we talk about his new book, The Coroner is Guilty. Thanks again, Hannah.
Thank you.
Escape the Narrative, Guerrilla Radio.
Provide protection, not to be a bullseye, but in the scopes of the IDF in their version of no quarter, first you kill the children and the reporters. If only it were not.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, last week I sat down for an extended interview with John Helmer. We covered the Iranian resistance to American and Western belligerence, Russia's role in reaction to that, and the release of John's new book, The Coroner is Guilty. John's a journalist and author. He spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has, as well as serving as advisor to governments at the highest level, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among John's many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, SOVCOM Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out, and Long Live Novichok, the British Poison Which Fooled the World. Here is an excerpt of the second half of our discussion from last week. Well, the idea that they would send these, and I know that you don't want to get into the military jargoneering and all of this, but these C-130s, there was two of them in this operation. It seems like that's a weird way to do a rescue mission, if that's all it was. The C-130 can carry, it says, up to 128 troops. The second one, presumably with the small helicopters and various gear on board, both of them. The story is just crazy that they were all destroyed on the ground because they got stuck in the mud after landing and they weren't shot down. They were blown up by the Americans themselves on the ground and everybody got out okay. Seems a bit of a stretch, especially when we think about Amanda Ryder, her documents. I mean, it was kind of weird that she would take them with her to begin with, but they being found charred and burned at the site, and what looks like some blood, if I'm not mistaken. Nothing seems to really add up here.
You're right. Nothing adds up to corroborate Trump's version. Trump's version, therefore, is not quite a lie. It's a disguise. It's a smokescreen. It's a camouflage. I'm awfully glad that the American Express card, no, don't leave home without it, was saved. Amanda Ryder's life has been saved is quite another matter. And just bear in mind who Amanda Ryder may also be. She may be the daughter of Major General, U.S. Air Force Major General Patrick Ryder, who had a long and distinguished military career and ended his career as the spokesman for the Pentagon, the press secretary of the Department of Defense in the final Biden years. He was spokesman for Lloyd Austin, the then Secretary of Defense. It's not clear that Pat Ryder is her father. It's been speculated in social media. The research I've done, which you can do yourselves, open source investigation, puts Ryder in the Vienna, Virginia area, where Ryder lived in much of the last decade of his military service when he worked at the Pentagon. And her studies in Nebraska still show her home residence as Vienna, Virginia. That's where Patrick Ryder almost certainly lived. Are they related? Ryder isn't saying so. The U.S. press isn't reporting it. The administration is shtum on this.
Yeah, would she leave the plane without her credit card? I mean,
Normally, when you evacuate a plane, aren't you told leave everything behind?
Yeah. Well, if the plane is on fire and stuff, but if you just land and get stuck in the sand, you would have presumably a little bit more time to grab your gear and go. But
true. And I've seen, without being mesmerized by the military details, those of us who want to look more expertly at the data and the pictures can provide better account than me. But those planes look as if they crash landed. Their propellers seem to be bent into the sand. It's not mud, it's sand. It's very clear that the U.S. Operation prior to Saturday, Sunday involved bombing and disrupting road links to that area as if to keep Iranian forces from coming close. That looks to have been a landing strip holding area for an operation that was to have landed there and moved out towards Isfahan area, I think about 10, 15 miles away. So the evidence of the crash site suggests crash landings, it's not clear whether that was a shoot-down crash landing or technical malfunctions, probably a combination of both. it suggests that there were Iranian forces near enough to ambush the incoming U.S. and maybe a post-event attempt to bomb the evidence into smithereens. Well, it failed to do so with respect to Ryder's documents. And the Iranian, it's up to the Iranians to provide more evidence. The Iranians have done a terrific job in 1980 in recovering the destroyed files of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. I've read all 20 volumes as they put those secret cables together. And the Iranians in 79, 80, 81 published them. And they're very interesting testimony to U.S. Middle Eastern policy. So if the Iranians have operational documents here, they will make use of them as they did once in 1980 against the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration.
Well, to forestall that, The Guardian reported yesterday that the uncrewed Reaper drones were striking Iranian military-aged males who got within 3 kilometers of the beeper signal of the supposed lost airman. I imagine that if that's not describing exactly protecting these downed aircraft instead of this guy that climbed a mountain while injured, they would have done the same thing for those as well. And this idea exactly. That they would shoot any so-called military-aged male, that has a familiar ring to it as well.
I agree with you there. Yes.
We're fast running out of time, but I don't want to leave without talking about your book. This is fresh out. It is probably, I would hazard, your most personal book, The Coroner is Guilty, as it regards the fate of your wife. What do you want to say about this book?
Well, the first thing to say about it is its title, The Coroner is Guilty. And then the opening line is, guilty of what? I've got to say, why should Canadians and North Americans read a book about a law case in Australia? Well, quickly, Australia is a vanguard state long ago ceased. Australia was a vanguard state in the 1970s. It became an empire dog pretty soon after. And all it does is bark while the empire caravan moves on. What this book does for the international audience is addresses two things, one of which is Australia remains in the vanguard. Canada has coronial courts. The United States has coronial courts. Coroners are part of the Anglo-American legal system, the Canadian system. And coroner's court in Australia, the one I'm in, the coroner's court of the state of Victoria, has been proved in a magistrate's court proceeding, to be the most corrupt court in the country, fined $400,000 and found guilty of internal toxic culture. I won't get into the details, they're in the book, but as a vanguard state, Australia leads in having punished a court for violating the laws under which that court acts. That's really unusual, and it suggests precedents which could be applied in Canada and the United States. First part. Second part, the Coroner's Court of Victoria is the court to which I applied for an investigation and inquest into the death of my wife, Tanya Turitsina. This is the bit that's difficult for me to talk about, and it'll always be difficult for me to talk about. Tanya died in Dubai of what the evidence, medical evidence, now shows to have been a toxic, lethal combination of prescription drugs, which had been prescribed for her by a doctor in Australia, a neurologist, and by a counterpart neurologist in Moscow. Tanya and I had sought the particular advice and expertise of those doctors on whether the combination of those drugs was in any way dangerous. And they said no, no, no. Now, all those listening who are potentially vulnerable to a combination of benzodiazepines used for various purposes and other drugs, which in combination can disrupt kidney function and liver function. Liver function has to be monitored in the case of the drugs that Tanya was prescribed to have to prevent the a liver enzyme failure. If that happens, the toxicity of the combination of those drugs builds up and triggers a massive heart attack. I'm afraid that's what happened to my Tanya. This heart attack, as a diagnosis of cause of death, is not uncommon in North America, especially for women suffering from vestibular migraine. Vestibular migraine, or VM, is an increasingly common ailment. It's not fatal. It's not necessarily comes with a migraine headache. It's basically starts with a vertigo or dizziness or dizzy spells. I won't go into the details. They're in the book. This is an increasing ailment, particularly affecting women. There's no understanding clearly of what causes it. There's no certainty about how to treat it. What we did, Tanya and I, was to try to verify whether there was a combination risk in the drugs she was taking, and we were assured that was not a risk. We were led astray. We were improperly advised. I sought in the court to examine this, not only for Tanya's case, but for the public interest in establishing whether a lot of heart attack cases, especially of women, were in fact the result of medical negligence, medical incompetence. So what the book is in effect a public appeal to everyone who has attempted to verify in good faith with their doctors what the risks are of the drugs they're taking for this particular non-lethal ailment that's becoming common. So the book turns out to be a jury book, a jury brief. It includes all the legal papers I filed in court to make my case. When the coroner tried to gag me, literally impose a ban on me submitting any more evidence, then I went to a higher court, the Victorian Supreme Court, where we tested against the coroner. I lost that case, and all of these litigations, you might say, are retold in the book. The book then asks the reader, you be the jury now, and you decide who's telling the truth and in what way the courts have violated Tanya's rights, rights in life, rights in death, my rights, and threatens a public interest. That's what this book is about. Combination risk for drugs leading to heart attack, which are misreported in the records and ignored by the courts of your country, the coroner's court in Canada, coroner's investigations in the United States, in the UK, and elsewhere. That's what the book aims to do. And I am now again in court, in the Supreme Court, because the coroner has issued a suppression order. That's an attempt to stop me publishing the book with a threat of sending me to prison with a fine unless I agree. So the book outside Australia is freely read. Inside Australia, it's subject to the coroner, who's the target of the book. The coroner is guilty, the subject of the book, subject of investigation. The coroner is attempting to suppress the book. So now again, I'm back in the Supreme Court to litigate, to defend myself, and have the court again adjudicate what's never happened before. This has never happened before. A higher court putting on trial a coroner for what he's done and what he hasn't done, what he said and what he didn't say, and what he's lied about.
Well, and in the blurb, you say this, quote, this book has become the jury book or brief of the case of suspicious sudden drug death, or suspicious rather, sudden drug death. It's now a model for the international public debate on corruption by the pharmaceutical companies in cahoots with government regulators, the medical profession, judges, and lawyers. It looks like you've chosen your enemies well this time, John.
No,
as ever.
They chose me. I'm fighting a defense here. What puts Australia in the vanguard, as far away from our audience as it's possible to be in geography, what puts Australia in the vanguard here is that in the past, in the case of a suicide of a lawyer working in the coroner's court, the coroner and the coroner's court have been put on trial in this jurisdiction and found guilty. That's unprecedented in legal history. It certainly hasn't happened in the UK. It hasn't happened in the US. I doubt it's happened in Canada. But if you go to the record of coroner's courts, something that we talked about with Guerrilla Radio and its audience for many years, and that is the behavior of the coroner's court in understanding the cause of death of victims of the MH17 shootdown back in July 2017. There was a Canadian who was killed in that air crash, and the Canadian coroner had the duty to a Canadian, his right in death, to investigate the cause of his death. Well, that you understand the cause of his death from a Canadian government point of view, from a Chrystia Freeland point of view, the cause of that Canadian's death was Russia. That was an absolute lie. We don't have to bang on that particular drum, but the coroner's court failed its duty to that young man who was a victim. The Australian coroner, however, dealing with, I believe, 34 Australian victims, Australian nationals, Australian residents, two coroner's courts had hearings. I wrote about them at the time. The Coroner's Court of Victoria in Melbourne and the Coroner's Court of New South Wales in Sydney. So the Australian coroner's courts were the only ones in the world. The UK coroner's court refused to open coroner's inquests into the deaths of four British citizens. They were ordered by the political boss of the coronial system, the Chancellor in London, to delay, to postpone. So in a certain sense, coroner's courts as investigators of cause of death are at the cutting edge of big political events like the shooting down of MH17. And the Canadian coroner's court denied that Canadian citizen his rights.
Yeah, well, the state of this country, Canada, I tell you, it's entirely unsurprising. John, we're out of time. Again, John's book, The Coroner is Guilty, you can get it online, except if you're in Australia, apparently, at the usual places you get things online. John, thanks a lot for coming on again today, and especially the extended sitting.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris. Until next time, let's be hopeful.
Yes, that's all we got for this time.
On top of your helmet, they can identify, is meant to provide protection, not to be a bullseye. But in the scopes of the IDF, in their version of no quarter, first you kill the children.